Side 2, The Way of Zen, continuing on page 31. There is a general consensus of scholars that the Pali Canon is on the whole the earlier of the two, and that the principal sutras, as the sacred texts are called, of the Mahayana Canon, were all compiled after 100 BC. However, the literary form of the Pali Canon does not suggest that it represents the actual words of Gautama the Buddha. If the Upanishads are characteristic of the style of discourse of an Indian teacher between 800 and 300 BC, they bear little resemblance to the tediously repetitious and scholastic style of most Buddhist scriptures. There can be little doubt that the greater part of both Buddhist canons is the work of the pandits of the Sangha, the Buddhist monastic order, for it shows every sign of being the reverential elaboration of an original doctrine. As with Russian icons, the original painting has been almost lost to sight in the overlay of jewels and gold. The third is that the Hindu-Buddhist tradition has never had the historical sense of the Hebrew-Christian tradition, so that there are few, if any, marks to indicate the date of a given text. Scriptures were handed down by oral tradition for an indeterminable period of time before being committed to writing, and it is quite possible that historical references could have been changed to suit the times as the oral form was handed down. Furthermore, a Buddhist monk writing in A.D. 200 would have no compunction in attributing his own words to the Buddha if he felt sincerely that they were an expression not of personal opinion but of the suprapersonal state of awakening to which he had attained. He would attribute the words to the Buddha as speaking in a spiritual rather than material body. The danger of scholarship is always that, in extreme specialization, it may be unable to see the forest for the trees. But the problem of gaining some idea of the thought of India at the time of the Buddha, 6 centuries before Christ, is not to be solved by careful piecework alone, necessary as this may be. There is, however, enough reliable information to suggest the grand and beautifully ordered form of Upanishadic Hinduism if we do not read it with our noses against the page. Fundamental to the life and thought of India from the very earliest times is the great mythological theme of Atma Yajna, the act of self-sacrifice whereby God gives birth to the world, and whereby men following the divine pattern reintegrate themselves with God. The act by which the world is created is the same act by which it is consummated, the giving up of one's life, as if the whole process of the universe were the type of game in which it is necessary to pass on the ball as soon as it is received. Thus, the basic myth of Hinduism is that the world is God playing hide-and-seek with himself, as Prajapati, Vishnu, or Brahma, the Lord, under many names, creates the world by an act of self-dismemberment or self-forgetting, whereby the one becomes many and the single actor plays innumerable parts. In the end, he comes again to himself, only to begin the play once more, the one dying into the many, and the many dying into the one. Quote, "A thousand heads hath Purusha, a thousand eyes, a thousand feet. On every side, pervading earth, he fills a space 10 fingers wide. This Purusha is all that yet hath been, and all that is to be, the Lord of immortality that waxes greater still by food. So mighty is his greatness, yea, greater than this is Purusha. All creatures are 1/4 of him, 3/4 eternal life in heaven. When the gods prepared the sacrifice with Purusha as their offering, its oil was spring, the holy gift was autumn, summer was the wood. From that great general sacrifice the dripping fat was gathered up. He formed the creatures of the air, and animals both wild and tame. When they divided Purusha, how many portions did they make? What do they call his mouth, his arms? What do they call his thighs and feet? The Brahman caste was his mouth. Of both his arms was the Rajanya, Kshatriya caste, made. His thighs became Vaishya. From his feet the Shudra was produced. The moon was gendered from his mind, and from his eye the sun had birth. Indra and Agni from his mouth were born, and Vayu from his breath. Forth from his navel came mid-air, the sky was fashioned from his head, earth from his feet, and from his ear the regions. Thus they formed the worlds." Quotation is from the Rig Veda, The translation is from R.T.H. Griffith. Purusha is the person, that is, the original consciousness behind the world. End of note. The thousand heads, eyes, and feet of the Purusha are the members of men and other beings, for the point is that that which knows in and through every individual is God himself, the Atman, or self of the world. Every life is a part or role in which the mind of God is absorbed, somewhat as an actor absorbs himself in being Hamlet and forgets that in real life he is Mr. Smith. By the act of self-abandonment, God becomes all beings, yet at the same time does not cease to be God. All creatures are one-fourth of him, three-fourths eternal life in heaven. For God is divided in play, in make-believe, but remains undivided in reality, so that when the play comes to an end, the individualized consciousness awakes to find itself divine. Quote, "In the beginning, this world was Atman, the self, alone in the form of Purusha. Looking about, he saw nothing other than himself. He said first, 'I am.' Thence came the word 'I.' Thus, even now, when one is spoken to, he first answers simply, 'It is I,' and then tells whatever name he has." End of quote. And another quote from the Bhagavad Gita. "On all sides, that has hands and feet. On all sides, eyes, heads, and faces. On all sides in the world it hears. All things it embraces." End of quote. It is important to remember that this picture of the world as the play, Lila, of God, is mythological in form. If at this stage we were to translate it directly into philosophical statement, it would be a crude type of pantheism, with which Hindu philosophy is generally and erroneously confused. Thus, the idea of each man, each thing, as a part which the Purusha plays in the state of self-forgetting must not be confused with a logical or scientific statement of fact. The form of statement is poetic, not logical. In the words of the Mundaka Upanishad, "Truly this Atman self, the poets say, travels on this earth from body to body." Hindu philosophy has not made the mistake of imagining that one can make an informative, factual, and positive statement about the ultimate reality. As the same Upanishad says, "Where knowledge is without duality, without action, cause or effect, unspeakable, incomparable, beyond description, what is that? It is impossible to say." Every positive statement about ultimate things must be made in the suggestive form of myth, of poetry. For in this realm, the direct and indicative form of speech can say only neti neti, no no, since what can be described and categorized must always belong to the conventional realm. Hindu mythology elaborates the theme of the divine play on a fabulous scale, embracing not only colossal concepts of time and space, but also the widest extremes of pleasure and pain, virtue and depravity. The inmost self of saint and sage is no less the veiled godhead than the inmost self of the debauchee, the coward, the lunatic, and the very demons. The opposites, dvandva, of light and darkness, good and evil, pleasure and pain, are the essential elements of the game. For although the godhead is identified with truth, sat, consciousness, chit, and bliss, ananda, the dark side of life has its integral part in the game, just as every drama must have its villain to disrupt the status quo, and as the cards must be shuffled, thrown into chaos, in order that there may be a significant development of the play. For Hindu thought, there is no problem of evil. The conventional relative world is necessarily a world of opposites. Light is inconceivable apart from darkness. Order is meaningless without disorder, and likewise up without down, sound without silence, pleasure without pain. In the words of Ananda Kumaraswamy, "For anyone who holds that God made the world, the question, why did he permit the existence in it of any evil, or of that evil one in whom all evil is personified, is altogether meaningless. One might as well inquire why he did not make a world without dimensions, or one without temporal succession." According to the myth, the divine play goes on through endless cycles of time. through periods of manifestation and withdrawal of the worlds measured in units of kalpas, the kalpa being a span of 4,320 million years. From the human standpoint, such a conception presents a terrifying monotony, since it goes on aimlessly, forever and ever. But from the divine standpoint, it has all the fascination of the repetitious games of children, which go on and on because time has been forgotten and has reduced itself to a single, wondrous instant. The foregoing myth is not the expression of a formal philosophy, but of an experience or state of consciousness which is called moksha, or liberation. On the whole, it is safer to say that Indian philosophy is primarily this experience. It is only quite secondarily a system of ideas which attempt to translate the experience into conventional language. At root, then, the philosophy becomes intelligible only by sharing the experience, which consists of the same type of non-conventional knowledge found in Taoism. It is also termed Atmajnana, self-knowledge, or Atmabodha, self-awakening, since it may be considered as the discovery of who or what I am when I am no longer identified with any role or conventional definition of the person. Indian philosophy does not describe the content of this discovery except in mythological terms, using the phrase, I am Brahman, aham Brahman, or that art thou, tattvamasi, to suggest that self-knowledge is a realization of one's original identity with God. But this does not imply what claiming to be God means in a Hebrew Christian context, where mythical language is ordinarily confused with factual language, so that there is no clear distinction between God, as described in the terms of conventional thought, and God as he is in reality. A Hindu does not say, I am Brahman, with the implication that he is personally in charge of the whole universe, and informed as to every detail of its operation. On the one hand, he is not speaking of identity with God at the level of his superficial personality. On the other, his God, Brahman, is not in charge of the universe in a personal way. He does not know and act in the manner of a person, since he does not know the universe in terms of conventional facts, nor act upon it by means of deliberation, effort, and will. It may be of significance that the word Brahman is from the root bri, to grow, since his creative activity, like that of the Tao, is with the spontaneity proper to growth, as distinct from the deliberation proper to making. Furthermore, though Brahman is said to know himself, this knowing is not a matter of information, a knowledge such as one has of objects, distinct from a subject, in the words of Shankara. For he is the knower, and the knower can know other things, but cannot make himself the object of his own knowledge, and in the same way that fire can burn other things, but cannot burn itself. Note, Bhashya on Kena Upanishad. Cannot may give the wrong implication, since the word is ordinarily privative. The point is that as light has no need to shine upon itself, since it is luminous already, so there is no advantage to be gained, and indeed no meaning, in the notion of Brahman's being the object of his own knowledge. End of note. To the Western mind, the puzzle of Indian philosophy is that it has so much to say about what the moksha experience is not, and little or nothing to say about what it is. This is naturally bewildering, for if the experience is really without content, or if it is so lacking in relation to the things which we consider important, how is one to explain the immense esteem which it holds in the Indian scheme of life? Even at the conventional level, it is surely easy to see that knowing what is not so is often quite as important as knowing what is. Even when medicine can suggest no effective remedy for the common cold, there is some advantage in knowing the uselessness of certain popular nostrums. Furthermore, the function of negative knowledge is not unlike the uses of space, the empty page upon which words can be written, the empty jar into which liquid can be poured, the empty window through which light can be admitted, and the empty pipe through which water can flow. Obviously, the value of emptiness lies in the movements it permits, or in the substance which it mediates and contains. But the emptiness must come first. This is why Indian philosophy concentrates on negation, on liberating the mind from concepts of truth. It proposes no idea, no description of what is to fill the mind's void, because the idea would exclude the fact, somewhat as a picture of the sun on the window pane would shut out the true sun's light. Whereas the Hebrews would not permit an image of God in wood or stone, the Hindus will not permit an image of thought, unless it be so obviously mythological as not to be mistaken for the reality. Therefore, the practical discipline, sadhana, of the way of liberation is a progressive disentanglement of one's self, Atman, from every identification. It is to realize that I am not this body, these sensations, these feelings, these thoughts, this consciousness. The basic reality of my life is not any conceivable object. Ultimately, it is not even to be identified with any idea, as of God or Atman. In the words of the Mandukya Upanishad, it is that which is conscious neither of the subjective nor of the objective, nor of both, which is neither simple consciousness, nor undifferentiated sentience, nor mere darkness. It is unseen, without relations, incomprehensible, uninferable, and indescribable, the essence of self-consciousness, the ending of Maya. End of quote. The Atman is to our total consciousness what the head is to the sense of sight. Neither light nor darkness, neither full nor empty, only an inconceivable beyond. In the moment when every last identification of the self with some object or concept has ceased, in the state called nirvikalpa, or without conception, there flashes forth from its unknown depths the state of consciousness which is called divine, the knowledge of Brahman. Translated into conventional and, let it be repeated, mytho-poetic language, the knowledge of Brahman is represented as the discovery that this world, which seemed to be many, is in truth one, that all is Brahman, and that all duality is falsely imagined. Taken as statements of fact, such utterances are logically meaningless and convey no information. Yet they seem to be the best possible expression in words of the experience itself, though it is as if in the moment of saying the last word, the tongue were paralyzed by its own revelation and compelled to babble nonsense or be silent. Moksha is also understood as liberation from Maya, one of the most important words in Indian philosophy, both Hindu and Buddhist. For the manifold world of facts and events is said to be Maya, ordinarily understood as an illusion which veils the one underlying reality of Brahman. This gives the impression that Moksha is a state of consciousness in which the whole varied world of nature vanishes from sight, merged in a boundless ocean of vaguely luminous space. Such an impression should be dismissed at once, for it implies a duality, an incompatibility between Brahman and Maya, which is against the whole principle of Upanishadic philosophy. For Brahman is not one as opposed to many, not simple as opposed to complex. Brahman is without duality, Advaita, which is to say, without any opposite, since Brahman is not in any class, or, for that matter, outside any class. Now, classification is precisely Maya. The word is derived from the Sanskrit root matra, to measure, form, build, or lay out a plan, the root from which we obtain such Greco-Latin words as meter, matrix, material, and matter. The fundamental process of measurement is division, whether by drawing a line with a finger, by marking off, or by enclosing circles with the span of the hand, or dividers, or by sorting grain or liquids into measures, cups. Thus, the Sanskrit root dva, from which we get the word divide, is also the root of the Latin duo, two, and the English dual. To say, then, that the world of facts and events is Maya is to say that facts and events are terms of measurement rather than realities of nature. We must, however, expand the concept of measurement to include setting bounds of all kinds, whether by descriptive classification or selective screening. It will thus be easy to see that facts and events are as abstract as lines of latitude, or as feet and inches. Consider for a moment that it is impossible to isolate a single fact all by itself. Facts come in pairs, at the very least, for a single body is inconceivable apart from a space in which it hangs. Definition, setting bounds, delineation, these are always acts of division and thus of duality, for as soon as a boundary is defined, it has two sides. This point of view is somewhat startling, and even quite hard to understand for those long accustomed to think that things, facts, and events are the very building blocks of the world, the most solid of solid realities. Yet a proper understanding of the Maya doctrine is one of the most essential prerequisites for the study of Hinduism and Buddhism, and in trying to grasp its meaning, one must try to put aside the various idealist philosophies of the West with which it is so often confused, even by modern Indian Vedantists. For the world is not an illusion of the mind in the sense that, to the eyes of the liberated man, Jivanmukta, there is nothing to be seen but a trackless void. He sees the world that we see, but he does not mark it off, measure it, divide it in the same way. He does not look upon it as really or concretely broken down into separate things and events. He sees that the skin may just as well be regarded as what joins us to our environment as what separates us from it. He sees, furthermore, that the skin will be considered as joining only if it has first been considered as separating, or vice versa. Thus, his point of view is not monistic. He does not think that all things are in reality one, because, concretely speaking, there never were any things to be considered one. To join is as much Maya as to separate. For this reason, both Hindus and Buddhists prefer to speak of reality as non-dual, rather than one, since the concept of one must always be in relation to that of many. The doctrine of Maya is therefore a doctrine of relativity. It is saying that things, facts, and events are delineated not by nature, but by human description, and that the way in which we describe or divide them is relative to our varying points of view. It is easy to see, for example, that an event called the First World War can only rather arbitrarily be said to have begun on August the 4th, 1914, and to have ended on November the 11th, 1918. Historians can discover actual beginnings of the war long before, and resumptions of the same strife long after these formal boundaries of the event. For events can divide and merge like blobs of mercury according to the changing fashions of historical description. The boundaries of events are conventional rather than natural, in the sense that a man's life is said to have begun at the moment of parturition, rather than at conception on the one hand, or weaning on the other. Similarly, it is easy to see the conventional character of things. Ordinarily, a human organism is counted as one thing, though from the physiological standpoint it is as many things as it has parts or organs, and from the sociological standpoint it is merely part of a larger thing called a group. Certainly the world of nature abounds with surfaces and lines, with areas of density and vacuity, which we employ in marking out the boundaries of events and things. But here again, the Maya doctrine asserts that these forms, rupa, have no own being or self-nature, svabhava. They do not exist in their own right, but only in relation to one another, as a solid cannot be distinguished save in relation to a space. In this sense, the solid and the space, the sound and the silence, the existent and the non-existent, the figure and the ground, are inseparable, interdependent, or mutually arising, and it is only by Maya or conventional division that they may be considered apart from one another. Indian philosophy also thinks of rupa, or form, as Maya, because it is impermanent. Indeed, when Hindu and Buddhist texts speak of the empty or illusory character of the visible world of nature, as distinct from the conventional world of things, they refer precisely to the impermanence of its forms. Form is flux, and thus Maya, in the slightly extended sense that it cannot be firmly marked down or grasped. form is Maya, when the mind attempts to comprehend and control it in the fixed categories of thought, that is, by means of names, nama, and words. For these are precisely the nouns and verbs by means of which the abstract and conceptual categories of things and events are designated. To serve their purpose, names and terms must of necessity be fixed and definite, like all other units of measurement. But their use is, up to a point, so satisfactory that man is always in danger of confusing his measures with the world so measured, of identifying money with wealth, fixed convention with fluid reality. But to the degree that he identifies himself and his life with these rigid and hollow frames of definition, he condemns himself to the perpetual frustration of one trying to catch water in a sieve. Thus, Indian philosophy speaks constantly of the unwisdom of pursuing things, of striving for the permanence of particular entities and events, because it sees in all this nothing more than infatuation with ghosts, with the abstract measures of the mind, manas. Maya is then usually equated with nama rupa, or name and form, with the mind's attempt to grasp the fluid forms of nature in its mesh of fixed classes. But when it is understood that form is ultimately void, in the special sense of ungraspable and immeasurable, the world of form is immediately seen as Brahman rather than Maya. The formal world becomes the real world in the moment when it is no longer clutched, in the moment when its changeful fluidity is no longer resisted. Hence it is the very transitoriness of the world which is the sign of its divinity, of its actual identity with the indivisible and immeasurable infinity of Brahman. This is why the Hindu-Buddhist insistence on the impermanence of the world is not the pessimistic and nihilistic doctrine which Western critics normally suppose it to be. Transitoriness is depressing only to the mind which insists upon trying to grasp. But to the mind which lets go and moves with the flow of change, which becomes, in Zen Buddhist imagery, like a ball in a mountain stream, the sense of transience or emptiness becomes a kind of ecstasy. This is perhaps why, in both East and West, impermanence is so often the theme of the most profound and moving poetry, so much so that the splendor of change shines through even when the poet seems to resent it the most. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Stated thus, as R. H. Blythe observed, it seems not so bad after all. In sum, then, the Maya doctrine points out, firstly, the impossibility of grasping the actual world in the mind's net of words and concepts, and secondly, the fluid character of those very forms which thought attempts to define. The world of facts and events is altogether nama, abstract names, and rupa, fluid form. It escapes both the comprehension of the philosopher and the grasp of the pleasure-seeker, like water from a clutching fist. There is even something deceptive in the idea of Brahman as the eternal reality underlying the flux, and of the Atman as the divine ground of human consciousness, for insofar as these are concepts, they are as incapable of grasping the real as any other. It is precisely this realization of the total elusiveness of the world which lies at the root of Buddhism. This is the special shift of emphasis which, more than anything else, distinguishes the doctrine of the Buddha from the teaching of the Upanishads, which is the raison d'etre for the growth of Buddhism as a distinct movement in Indian life and thought. For Gautama, the awakened one, or Buddha, died circa 545 BC, lived at a time when the major Upanishads were already in existence, and their philosophy must be seen as the point of departure for his own teaching. It would be a serious mistake, however, to look upon the Buddha as the founder or reformer of a religion which came into being as some kind of organized revolt against Hinduism. We are speaking of a time when there was no consciousness of religions, when such terms as Hinduism or Brahmanism would have meant nothing. There was simply a tradition embodied in the orally transmitted doctrine of the Vedas and Upanishads, a tradition that was not specifically religious in that it involved a whole way of life and concerned everything from the methods of agriculture to the knowledge of the ultimate reality. The Buddha was acting in full accord with this tradition when he became a rishi, or forest sage, who had abandoned the life of the householder and divested himself of caste in order to follow a way of liberation. As with every other rishi, the method of his way of liberation had certain characteristic features, and his doctrine contained criticisms of men's failure to practice the tradition which they professed. Furthermore, he was being entirely traditional in his abandonment of caste and in accepting a following of casteless and homeless students. For the Indian tradition, even more than the Chinese, specifically encourages the abandonment of the conventional life at a certain age, after the duties of family and citizenship have been fulfilled. Relinquishment of caste is the outward and visible sign of the realization that one's true state is unclassified, that one's role or person is simply conventional, and that one's true nature is no thing and no body. This realization was the crux of the Buddha's experience of awakening, Bodhi, which dawned upon him one night as he sat under the celebrated Bo tree at Gaya after 7 years of meditation in the forests. From the standpoint of Zen, this experience is the essential content of Buddhism, and the verbal doctrine is quite secondary to the wordless transmission of the experience itself from generation to generation. For 7 years, Gautama had struggled by the traditional means of yoga and tapas, contemplation and ascesis, to penetrate the cause of man's enslavement to Maya, to find release from the vicious circle of clinging to life, Krishna, which is like trying to make the hand grasp itself. All his efforts had been in vain. The eternal Atman, the real self, was not to be found. However much he concentrated upon his own mind to find its root and ground, he found only his own effort to concentrate. The evening before his awakening, he simply gave up, relaxed his ascetic diet, and ate some nourishing food. Thereupon he felt at once that a profound change was coming over him. He sat beneath the tree, vowing never to rise until he had attained the supreme awakening, and, according to a tradition, sat all through the night until the first glimpse of the morning star suddenly provoked a state of perfect clarity and understanding. This was Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, an excelled, complete awakening. Liberation from Maya, and from the everlasting round of birth and death, samsara, which goes on for as long as a man tries in any way whatsoever to grasp at his own life. Yet the actual content of this experience was never and could never be put into words. For words are the frames of Maya, the meshes of its net, and the experience is of the water which slips through. Thus, so far as words are concerned, the most that may be said of this experience are the words attributed to the Buddha in the Vajracchedika. Just so, Subhuti, I obtained not the least thing from unexcelled complete awakening, and for this very reason it is called unexcelled complete awakening. Thus, from the standpoint of Zen, the Buddha never said a word, despite the volumes of scriptures attributed to him. For his real message remained always unspoken, and was such that, when words attempted to express it, they made it seem as if it were nothing at all. Yet it is the essential tradition of Zen that what cannot be conveyed by speech can nevertheless be passed on by direct pointing, by some non-verbal means of communication, without which the Buddhist experience could never have been handed down to future generations. In its own, probably rather late, tradition, Zen maintains that the Buddha transmitted awakening to his chief disciple, Mahakasyapa, by holding up a flower and remaining silent. The Pali canon, however, relates that immediately after his awakening, the Buddha went to the deer park at Benares and set forth his doctrine to those who had formerly been his companions in the ascetic life, expressing it in the form of those four noble truths which provide so convenient a summary of Buddhism. These four truths are patterned on the traditional Vedic form of a physician's diagnosis and prescription, the identification of the disease and of its cause, the pronouncement as to whether it may be cured, and the prescription for the remedy. The first truth is concerned with the problematic word dukkha, loosely translatable as suffering, and which designates the great disease of the world for which the Buddha's method, Dharma, is the cure. Quote, "Birth is dukkha, decay is dukkha, sickness is dukkha, death is dukkha, so also are sorrow and grief. To be bound with things which we dislike and to be parted from things which we like, these also are dukkha. Not to get what one desires, this also is dukkha. In a word, this body, this fivefold aggregation based on clutching Krishna, this is dukkha." From the Samyutta Nikaya. This, however, cannot quite be compressed into the sweeping assertion that life is suffering. The point is rather that life as we usually live it is suffering, or more exactly, is bedeviled by the peculiar frustration which comes from attempting the impossible. Perhaps then, frustration is the best equivalent for dukkha, even though the word is the simple antonym of sukha, which means pleasant or sweet. Note, or if we were to translate dukkha as sour, we might say that the Buddha's doctrine is that life is soured by man's grasping attitude towards it, as milk turns sour when kept too long. End of note. In another formulation of the Buddha's teaching, dukkha is one of the three characteristics of being, or becoming, bhava, whereof the other two are anicca, impermanence, and anatman, absence of any self. These two terms are of basic importance. The anicca doctrine is, again, not quite the simple assertion that the world is impermanent, but rather that the more one grasps at the world, the more it changes. Reality in itself is neither permanent nor impermanent, it cannot be categorized. But when one tries to hold on to it, change is everywhere apparent, since, like one's own shadow, the faster one pursues it, the faster it flees. In the same way, the Anatman doctrine is not quite the bald assertion that there is no real self, Atman, at the basis of our consciousness. The point is rather that there is no self, or basic reality, which may be grasped either by direct experience or by concepts. Apparently, the Buddha felt that the doctrine of the Atman in the Upanishads lent itself too easily to a fatal misinterpretation. It became an object of belief, a desideratum, a goal to be reached, something to which the mind could cling as its one final abode of safety in the flux of life. The Buddha's view was that a self so grasped was no longer the true self, but only one more of the innumerable forms of Maya. Thus, Anatman might be expressed in the form, the true self is non-self, since any attempt to conceive the self, believe in the self, or seek for the self, immediately thrusts it away. The Upanishads distinguish between Atman, the true, supra-individual self, and the Jivatman, or individual soul. And the Buddha's Anatman doctrine agrees with them in denying the reality of the latter. It is fundamental to every school of Buddhism that there is no ego, no enduring entity, which is the constant subject of our changing experiences, for the ego exists in an abstract sense alone, being an abstraction from memory, somewhat like the illusory circle of fire made by a whirling torch. We can, for example, imagine the path of a bird through the sky as a distinct line which it has taken, but this line is as abstract as a line of latitude. In concrete reality, the bird left no line. And similarly, the past from which our ego is abstracted has entirely disappeared. Thus, any attempt to cling to the ego or to make it an effective source of action is doomed to frustration. The second noble truth relates to the cause of frustration, which is said to be Trishna, clinging or grasping, based on avidya, which is ignorance or unconsciousness. Now, avidya is the formal opposite of awakening. It is the state of the mind when hypnotized or spellbound by Maya, so that it mistakes the abstract world of things and events for the concrete world of reality. At a still deeper level, it is lack of self-knowledge, lack of the realization that all grasping turns out to be the futile effort to grasp oneself, or rather to make life catch hold of itself. For to one who has self-knowledge, there is no duality between himself and the external world. Avidya is ignoring the fact that subject and object are relational, like the two sides of a coin, so that when one pursues, the other retreats. That is why the egocentric attempt to dominate the world, to bring as much of the world as possible under the control of the ego, has only to proceed for a little while before it raises the difficulty of the ego's controlling itself. This is really a simple problem of what we now call cybernetics, the science of control. Mechanically and logically, it is easy to see that any system approaching perfect self-control is also approaching perfect self-frustration. Such a system is a vicious circle and has the same logical structure as a statement which states something about itself, as, for example, I am lying, when it is implied that the statement is itself a lie. The statement circulates fatuously forever, since it is always true to the extent that it is false, and false to the extent that it is true. Expressed more concretely, I cannot throw a ball so long as I am holding on to it so as to maintain perfect control of its movement. Thus, the desire for perfect control of the environment and of oneself is based on a profound mistrust of the controller. Avidya is the failure to see the basic self-contradiction of this position. From it, therefore, arises a futile grasping or controlling of life which is pure self-frustration, and the pattern of life which follows is the vicious circle which in Hinduism and Buddhism is called samsara, the round of birth and death. Note, the dynamic structure of the round is called praticca samuppada, the 12-fold chain of dependent origination in which the 12 causal links give rise to one another mutually, constituting a closed circle without beginning or end. Thus, ignorance, avidya, gives rise to motivation, samskara, and this in series to consciousness, vijnana, name and form, namarupa, the six senses, shadayatana, sense stimulation, sparsa, sense experience, vedana, grasping, trishna, possessiveness, upadana, coming to be, bhava, birth, jati, and old age and death, jaramarana, which again gives rise to avidya. The Buddha explained that avidya was put first on the list, not because it was the temporal beginning of the series, but for simple convenience of exposition. The whole series arises together, and its terms exist only in relation to one another. End of note. The active principle of the round is known as karma, or conditioned action. Action, that is, arising from a motive and seeking a result. The type of action which always requires the necessity for further action. Man is involved in karma when he interferes with the world in such a way that he is compelled to go on interfering, when the solution of a problem creates still more problems to be solved, when the control of one thing creates the need to control several others. Karma is thus the fate of everyone who tries to be God. He lays a trap for the world in which he himself gets caught. Many Buddhists understand the round of birth and death quite literally as a process of reincarnation, wherein the karma which shapes the individual does so again and again in life after life, until through insight and awakening it is laid to rest. But in Zen, and in other schools of the Mahayana, it is often taken in a more figurative way, as that the process of rebirth is from moment to moment, so that one is being reborn so long as one identifies himself with a continuing ego which reincarnates itself afresh at each moment of time. Thus, the validity and interest of the doctrine does not require acceptance of a special theory of survival. Its importance is rather that it exemplifies the whole problem of action in vicious circles and its resolution. And in this respect, Buddhist philosophy should have a special interest for students of communication theory, cybernetics, logical philosophy, and similar matters. The third noble truth is concerned with the ending of self-frustration, of grasping, and of the whole viciously circular pattern of karma which generates the round. The ending is called nirvana, a word of such dubious etymology that a simple translation is exceedingly difficult. It has been variously connected with Sanskrit roots, which would make it mean the blowing out of a flame, or simply blowing out X or D spiration, or with the cessation of waves, turnings, or circlings, vritti, of the mind. The two latter interpretations seem on the whole to make most sense. If nirvana is de-spiration, it is the act of one who has seen the futility of trying to hold his breath or life, prana, indefinitely, since to hold the breath is to lose it. Thus, nirvana is the equivalent of moksha, release or liberation. Seen from one side, it appears to be despair, the recognition that life utterly defeats our efforts to control it, that all human striving is no more than a vanishing hand clutching at clouds. Seen from the other side, this despair bursts into joy and creative power on the principle that to lose one's life is to find it, to find freedom of action unimpeded by self-frustration and the anxiety inherent in trying to save and control the self. If nirvana is related to the cessation, nir, of turnings, vritti, the term is synonymous with the aim of yoga, defined in the Yoga Sutra as chittavritti nirodha, the cessation of turnings of the mind. These turnings are the thoughts whereby the mind endeavors to grasp the world and itself. Yoga is the practice of trying to stop these thoughts by thinking about them, until the utter futility of the process is felt so vividly that it simply drops away, and the mind discovers its natural and unconfused state. It is obvious, however, that both etymologies give us the same essential meaning. Nirvana is the way of life which ensues when clutching at life has come to an end. Insofar as all definition is clutching, nirvana is necessarily indefinable. It is the natural, unself-grasped state of the mind. And here, of course, the mind has no specific meaning, for what is not grasped is not known in the conventional sense of knowledge. More popularly and literally understood, nirvana is the disappearance of the being from the round of incarnations, not into a state of annihilation, but simply into a state escaping definition, and thus immeasurable and infinite. To attain nirvana is also to attain Buddhahood, awakening. But this is not attainment in any ordinary sense, because no acquisition and no motivation are involved. It is impossible to desire nirvana, or to intend to reach it, for anything desirable or conceivable as an object of action is, by definition, not nirvana. Nirvana can only arise unintentionally, spontaneously, when the impossibility of self-grasping has been thoroughly perceived. A Buddha, therefore, is a man of no rank. He is not above, like an angel. He is not below, like a demon. He does not appear anywhere in the six divisions of the round, and it would be mistaken to think of him as superior to the angels, for the law of the round is that what goes up must come down, and vice versa. He has transcended all dualities whatsoever, and thus it would mean nothing to him to think of himself as a superior person or a spiritual success. The fourth noble truth describes the eightfold path of the Buddha's Dharma, that is, the method or doctrine whereby self-frustration is brought to an end. Each section of the path has a name preceded by the word Samyak, Pali Sama, which has the meaning of perfect or complete. The first two sections have to do with thought, the following four have to do with action, and the final two have to do with contemplation or awareness. We therefore have 1. Samyak drishti, or complete view, 2, Samyak Sankalpa, or complete understanding. 3, Samyak Vak, or complete, that is, truthful, speech. 4, Samyak Karmanta, or complete action. 5, Samyak Ajiva, or complete vocation. 6, Samyak Vyayama, or complete application. 7, Samyak Smriti, or complete recollectedness. 8, Samyak Samadhi, or complete contemplation. Without discussing these sections in detail, it may simply be said that the first two are concerned with a proper understanding of the doctrine and of the human situation. In some ways, the first section, Complete View, contains all the others, since the method of Buddhism is above all the practice of clear awareness, of seeing the world yathābhūtam, just as it is. Such awareness is a lively attention to one's direct experience, to the world as immediately sensed, so as not to be misled by names and labels. Samyak Samadhi, the last section of the path, is the perfection of the first, signifying pure experience, pure awareness, wherein there is no longer the dualism of the knower and the known. The sections dealing with action are often misunderstood because they have a deceptive similarity to a system of morals. Buddhism does not share the Western view that there is a moral law enjoined by God or by nature, which it is man's duty to obey. The Buddha's precepts of conduct, abstinence from taking life, taking what is not given, exploitation of the passions, lying, and intoxication, are voluntarily assumed rules of expediency, the intent of which is to remove the hindrances to clarity of awareness. Failure to observe the precepts produces bad karma, not because karma is a law or moral retribution, but because all motivated and purposeful actions, whether conventionally good or bad, are karma insofar as they are directed to the grasping of life. Generally speaking, the conventionally bad actions are rather more grasping than the good. But the higher stages of Buddhist practice are as much concerned with disentanglement from good karma as from bad. Thus, complete action is ultimately free, uncontrived, or spontaneous action, in exactly the same sense as the Taoist Wu Wei. Note, technically such action would be called akarma, unconditioned action, or asamskrita, uncontrived action. End of note. Smriti, recollectedness, and samadhi, contemplation, constitute the section dealing with the life of meditation, the inner mental practice of the Buddha's way. Complete recollectedness is a constant awareness or watching of one's sensations, feelings, and thoughts without purpose or comment. It is a total clarity and presence of mind, actively passive, wherein events come and go like reflections in a mirror. Nothing is reflected except what is. Quote, in walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, he understands that he is so doing, so that however his body is engaged, he understands it just as it is, in setting out or returning, in looking before or around, in bending or stretching his arm, he acts with clear awareness. From the Majjhima Nikaya. Through such awareness it is seen that the separation of the thinker from the thought, the knower from the known, the subject from the object is purely abstract. There is not the mind on the one hand and its experiences on the other. There is just a process of experiencing in which there is nothing to be grasped, as an object and no one as a subject to grasp it. Seen thus, the process of experiencing ceases to clutch at itself. Thought follows thought without interruption, that is, without any need to divide itself from itself so as to become its own object. Quote, where there is an object, there thought arises. Is then the thought one thing and the object another? No. What is the object? Just that is the thought. If the object were one thing and the thought another, then there would be a double state of thought. So the object itself is just thought. Can then thought review thought? No, thought cannot review thought, as the blade of a sword cannot cut itself, as a fingertip cannot touch itself, so a thought cannot see itself. From the Sikshasa Muchaya, translated by Kanz. This non-duality of the mind, in which it is no longer divided against itself, is samadhi, and because of the disappearance of that fruitless threshing around of the mind to grasp itself, samadhi is a state of profound peace. This is not the stillness of total inactivity, for once the mind returns to its natural state, samadhi persists at all times, in walking, standing, sitting, and lying. But from the earliest times, Buddhism has especially emphasized the practice of recollectedness and contemplation while sitting. Most images of the Buddha show him in the posture of sitting meditation, in the particular attitude known as Padmasana, the posture of the lotus, with the legs crossed and the feet resting, soles upward upon the thighs. Sitting meditation is not, as is often supposed, a spiritual exercise, a practice followed for some ulterior object. From a Buddhist standpoint, it is simply the proper way to sit, and it seems perfectly natural to remain sitting so long as there is nothing else to be done, and so long as one is not consumed with nervous agitation. To the restless temperament of the West, sitting meditation may seem to be an unpleasant discipline, because we do not seem to be able to sit, just to sit, without qualms of conscience, without feeling that we ought to be doing something more important to justify our existence. To propitiate this restless conscience, sitting meditation must therefore be regarded as an exercise, a discipline with an ulterior motive. Yet at that very point it ceases to be meditation, dhyana, in the Buddhist sense, for where there is purpose, where there is seeking and grasping for results, there is no dhyana. This word dhyana, Pali jhana, is the original Sanskrit form of the Chinese jhan and the Japanese zen, and thus its meaning is of central importance for an understanding of Zen Buddhism. Meditation, in the common sense of thinking things over or musing, is a most misleading translation. But such alternatives as trance or absorption are even worse, since they suggest states of hypnotic fascination. The best solution seems to be to leave dhyana untranslated and add it to the English language, as we have added nirvana and dao. Note, the Pali canon lists 8 types of jhana, the 4 rupa jhana and the 4 arupa jhana, the states of jhana with form and without form. The first 4 involve the progressive settling of conception, vitaka, and discursive thought, vichara, into a state of equanimity, upekkha, through the practice of samadhi. In other words, as the mind returns to its natural state of integrity and non-duality, it ceases to clutch at experience with the symbols of discursive thought. It simply perceives without words or concepts. Beyond this lie the 4 arupa jhana, described as the spheres of boundless space, boundless consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception, which are stages of the mind's realization of its own nature. At the time of his death, the Buddha is said to have entered into parinirvana, that is, final nirvana, from the 4th rupa jhana. End of note. As used in Buddhism, the term dhyana comprises both recollectedness, smriti, and samadhi, and can best be described as the state of unified or one-pointed awareness. On the one hand, it is one-pointed in the sense of being focused on the present, since to clear awareness there is neither past nor future, but just this one moment, ekaksana, which Western mystics have called the eternal now. On the other hand, it is one-pointed in the sense of being a state of consciousness without differentiation of the knower, the knowing, and the known. Quote, a Tathagata, that is, a Buddha, is a seer of what is to be seen, but he is not mindful, na manati, or does not conceive, of the seen, the unseen, the seeable, or the seer. So too with the heard, the sensed, and the known, he does not think of them in these categories. From the Anguttara Nikaya. The difficulty of appreciating what dhyana means is that the structure of our language does not permit us to use a transitive verb without a subject and a predicate. When there is knowing, grammatical convention requires that there must be someone who knows and something which is known. We are so accustomed to this convention in speaking and thinking that we fail to recognize that it is simply a convention, and that it does not necessarily correspond to the actual experience of knowing. Thus, when we say, a light flashed, it is somewhat easier to see through the grammatical convention and to realize that the flashing is the light. But dhyana, as the mental state of the liberated or awakened man, is naturally free from the confusion of conventional entities with reality. Our intellectual discomfort in trying to conceive knowing without a distinct someone who knows and a distinct something which is known is like the discomfort of arriving at a formal dinner in pyjamas. The error is conventional, not existential. Once again, therefore, we see how convention, how the maya of measurement and description, populates the world with those ghosts which we call entities and things. So hypnotic, so persuasive is the power of convention that we begin to feel these ghosts as realities, and make of them our loves, our ideals, our prized possessions. But the anxiety-laden problem of what will happen to me when I die is, after all, like asking what happens to my fist when I open my hand, or where my lap goes when I stand up. Perhaps, then, we are now able to understand the celebrated summary of the Buddha's doctrine given in the Visuddhimagga. Suffering alone exists, none who suffer. The deed there is, but no doer thereof. Nirvana is, but no one seeking it. The path there is, but none who travel it. Chapter 3. Mahayana Buddhism. Because the teaching of the Buddha was a way of liberation, it had no other object than the experience of nirvana. The Buddha did not attempt to set forth a consistent philosophical system, trying to satisfy that intellectual curiosity about ultimate things which expects answers in words. When pressed for such answers, when questioned about the nature of nirvana, the origin of the world and the reality of the self, the Buddha maintained a noble silence, and went on to say that such questions were irrelevant and did not lead to the actual experience of liberation. It has often been said that the later development of Buddhism was due to the inability of the Indian mind to rest content with that silence, so that at last it had to indulge its overwhelming urge for abstract metaphysical speculations about the nature of reality. Such a view of the genesis of Mahayana Buddhism is, however, rather misleading. The vast body of Mahayana doctrine arose not so much to satisfy intellectual curiosity as to deal with the practical psychological problems encountered in following the Buddha's way. Certainly, the treatment of these problems is highly scholastic, and the intellectual level of the Mahayana texts is very lofty. But the consistent aim is to bring about the experience of liberation, not to construct a philosophical system. In the words of Sir Arthur Berrydale Keith, the metaphysics of the Mahayana, in the incoherence of its systems, shows clearly enough the secondary interest attaching to it in the eyes of the monks, whose main interest was concentrated on the attainment of release. The Mahayana, no less than the Hinayana, is concerned vitally with this practical end, and its philosophy is of value merely in so far as it helps men to attain their aim. End of quote. There are no doubt respects in which Mahayana Buddhism is a concession both to intellectual curiosity and to a popular desire for shortcuts to the goal. But at root, it is the work of highly sensitive and perceptive minds studying their own inner workings. To anyone who is highly self-aware, the Buddhism of the Pali Canon leaves many practical problems unanswered. Its psychological insight goes little further than the construction of analytical catalogues of mental functions, and though its precepts are clear, it is not always helpful in explaining their practical difficulties. Perhaps it is too sweeping a generalization, but one receives the impression that whereas the Pali Canon would unlock the door to nirvana by sheer effort, the Mahayana would jiggle the key until it turns smoothly. Thus, the great concern of the Mahayana is the provision of skillful means, upaya, for making nirvana accessible to every type of mentality. How and when the Mahayana doctrines arose is a matter of historical guesswork. The great Mahayana sutras are ostensibly the teachings of the Buddha and his immediate disciples. But their style is so different, and their doctrine so much more subtle than that of the Pali canon, that scholars almost unanimously assign them to later dates. There is no evidence of their existence in the time of the great Buddhist emperor Asoka, grandson of Chandragupta Maurya, who was converted to Buddhism in 262 BC. Asoka's rock inscriptions reflect no more than the social teachings of the Pali canon, its insistence on ahimsa, or non-violence, to both men and animals, and its general precepts for the life of the laity. The principal Mahayana texts were being translated into Chinese by Kumarajiva shortly after AD 400, but our knowledge of Indian history during the intervening 600 years from Asoka's death is so fragmentary, and the internal evidences of the sutras themselves so vague, that we can do little more than assign them to the 400 years between 100 BC and AD 300. Even specific individuals associated with their development, Asvaghosha, Nagarjuna, Asanga, and Vasubandhu, can be dated only very approximately. The traditional Mahayanist account of its own origin is that its teachings were delivered by the Buddha to his intimate disciples, but their public revelation withheld until the world was ready for them. The principle of delayed revelation is a well-known expedient for permitting the growth of a tradition, for exploring the implications contained in the original seed. Apparent contradictions between earlier and later doctrines are explained by assigning them to different levels of truth, ranging from the most relative to the absolute, and of which the probably quite late Avatamsaka school distinguishes no less than five. However, the problem of the historical origins of the Mahayana is of no very direct importance for an understanding of Zen, which as a Chinese rather than Indian form of Buddhism came into being when Indian Mahayana was fully grown. We can pass on, therefore, to the central Mahayana doctrines from which Zen arose. The Mahayana distinguishes itself from the Buddhism of the Pali canon by terming the latter the little Hina, vehicle, Yana, of liberation, and itself the great Maha, vehicle. Great because it comprises such a wealth of upaya, or methods, for the realization of nirvana. These methods range from the sophisticated dialectic of Nagarjuna, whose object is to free the mind of all fixed conceptions, to the Sukhavati, or pure land doctrine of liberation, through faith in the power of Amitabha, the Buddha of boundless light, who is said to have attained his awakening many eons before the time of Gautama. They include even the tantric Buddhism of medieval India, wherein liberation may be realized through the repetition of sacred words and formulae called dharani, and through special types of yoga involving sexual intercourse with a shakti, or spiritual wife. Note, the alleged obscenity of maituna, as this practice is called, is entirely in the minds of Christian missionaries. In fact, the relationship with the shakti was anything but promiscuous, and involved the mature and all too infrequent notion of a man and a woman undertaking their spiritual development in common. This included a sanctification of the sexual relationship, which should logically have been part of the Catholic view of marriage as a sacrament. End of note. A preliminary study of the Pali canon will certainly give the impression that nirvana is to be realized only through rigorous effort and self-control, and that the aspirant should lay aside all other concerns for the pursuit of this ideal. Mahayanists may be perfectly correct in assuming that the Buddha intended this emphasis as an upaya, a skillful means of enabling one to realize concretely and vividly the absurd vicious circle of desiring not to desire, or of trying to get rid of selfishness by oneself. For this is certainly the conclusion to which the practice of the Buddha's doctrine led. It may be attributed to laziness and loss of nerve, but it seems more plausible to suggest that those who remained in the path of self-deliverance were merely unconscious of the paradox involved. For wherever the Mahayana continues to teach the way of liberation by one's own effort, it does so as an expedient for bringing the individual to a vivid awareness of his own futility. Various indications suggest that one of the earliest notions of the Mahayana was the conception of the Bodhisattva, not simply as a potential Buddha, but as one who, by renouncing nirvana, was at a higher spiritual level than one who attained it and so withdrew from the world of birth and death. In the Pali canon, the disciples of the Buddha who attain nirvana are termed arhans, or worthy ones. But in the Mahayana texts, the ideal of the arhan is accounted almost selfish. It is fit only for the sravaka, the hearer of the doctrine, who has progressed only so far as to get a theoretical understanding. The Bodhisattva, however, is one who realizes that there is a profound contradiction in a nirvana attained by himself and for himself. From the popular standpoint, the Bodhisattva became a focus of devotion, bhakti, a savior of the world who had vowed not to enter the final nirvana until all other sentient beings had likewise attained it. For their sakes, he consented to be born again and again into the round of samsara, until, in the course of innumerable ages, even the grass and the dust had attained Buddhahood. But from a deeper standpoint, it became obvious that the idea of the Bodhisattva is implicit in the logic of Buddhism, that it flows naturally from the principle of not grasping and from the doctrine of the unreality of the ego. For if nirvana is the state in which the attempt to grasp reality has wholly ceased through the realization of its impossibility, it will obviously be absurd to think of nirvana itself as something to be grasped or attained. If, furthermore, the ego is merely a convention, it is nonsense to think of nirvana as a state to be attained by some being. As is said in the Vajracchedita, all bodhisattva heroes should cultivate their minds to think. All sentient beings of whatever class are caused by me to attain the boundless liberation of nirvana. Yet when vast, innumerable, and immeasurable numbers of beings have thus been liberated, in truth no being has been liberated. Why is this, Subhuti? It is because no bodhisattva, who is truly a bodhisattva, holds to the idea of an ego, a personality, a being, or a separate individual. End of quote. The corollary of this position is that if there is no nirvana which can be attained, and if in reality there are no individual entities, it will follow that our bondage in the round is merely apparent, and that, in fact, we are already in nirvana, so that to seek nirvana is the folly of looking for what one has never lost. Naturally, then, the Bodhisattva makes no motion to depart from the round of samsara as if nirvana were somewhere else, for to do so would imply that nirvana is something that needs to be attained, and that samsara is an actual reality. In the words of the Lankavatara Sutra, those who, afraid of the sufferings arising from the discrimination of birth and death, samsara, seek for nirvana, do not know that birth and death and nirvana are not to be separated from one another. And seeing that all things subject to discrimination have no reality, they imagine that nirvana consists in the future annihilation of the senses and their field. Note, in Suzuki, the fields of the senses are the areas or aspects of the external world to which the particular sense organs are related. End of note. To strive, then, to blot out the conventional world of things and events is to admit that it exists in reality. Hence, the Mahayanist principle that what has never arisen does not have to be annihilated. These are not the idle speculations and sophistries of a system of subjective idealism or nihilism. They are answers to a practical problem which may be expressed thus. If my grasping of life involves me in a vicious circle, how am I to learn not to grasp? How can I try to let go when trying is precisely not letting go? Stated in another way, to try not to grasp is the same thing as to grasp, since its motivation is the same, my urgent desire to save myself from a difficulty. I cannot get rid of this desire, since it is one and the same desire as the desire to get rid of it. This is the familiar everyday problem of the psychological double bind, of creating the problem by trying to solve it, of worrying because one worries, and of being afraid of fear. Mahayana philosophy proposes a drastic but effective answer, which is the theme of a class of literature called Prajnaparamita, or Wisdom for Crossing to the Other Shore, a literature closely associated with the work of Nagarjuna, circa AD 200, who ranks with Shankara as one of the greatest minds of India. Stated boldly, the answer is that all grasping, even for nirvana, is futile, for there is nothing to be grasped. This is Nagarjuna's celebrated Sunyavada, his doctrine of the void, otherwise known as the Madhyamika, the middle way, because it refutes all metaphysical propositions by demonstrating their relativity. From the standpoint of academic philosophy, the Prajnaparamita and the doctrine of Nagarjuna are no doubt some form of nihilism or absolute relativism, but this is not Nagarjuna's standpoint. The dialectic with which he demolishes every conception of reality is merely a device for breaking the vicious circle of grasping, and the terminus of his philosophy is not the abject despair of nihilism, but the natural and uncontrived bliss, ananda, of liberation. The Sunyavada takes its name from the term sunya, void, or sunyata, voidness, with which Nagarjuna described the nature of reality, or rather of the conceptions of reality which the human mind can form. Conceptions here include not only metaphysical views, but also ideals, religious beliefs, ultimate hopes and ambitions of every kind, everything which the mind of man seeks and grasps for his physical or spiritual security. Not only does the Sunyavada demolish the beliefs which one consciously adopts, it also seeks out the hidden and unconscious premises of thought and action, and submits them to the same treatment until the very depths of the mind are reduced to total silence. Even the idea of sunya is itself to be voided. Quote, "It cannot be called void or not void, or both, or neither. But in order to point it out, it is called the void." From the Madhyamika Shastra. Shcherbatsky is certainly right in thinking that the Sunyavada is best called a doctrine of relativity. For Nagarjuna's method is simply to show that all things are without self-nature, svabhava, or independent reality, since they exist only in relation to other things. Nothing in the universe can stand by itself. No thing, no fact, no being, no event. And for this reason, it is absurd to single anything out as the ideal to be grasped. For what is singled out exists only in relation to its own opposite, since what is defined by what is not. Pleasure is defined by pain, life is defined by death, and motion is defined by stillness. Obviously, the mind can form no idea of what to be means without the contrast of not to be, since the ideas of being and non-being are abstractions from such simple experiences as that there is a penny in the right hand and no penny in the left. From one point of view, the same relativity exists between nirvana and samsara, body, awakening, and klesa, defilement. That is to say, the search for nirvana implies the existence and the problem of samsara, and the quest for awakening implies that one is in the state of defilement with delusion. To put it in another way, as soon as nirvana is made an object of desire, it becomes an element of samsara. The real nirvana cannot be desired, because it cannot be conceived. Thus the Lankavatara Sutra says, "Again, Mahamati, what is meant by non-duality? It means that light and shade, long and short, black and white, are relative terms, Mahamati, and not independent of each other. As nirvana and samsara are, all things are not two. There is no nirvana except where is samsara. There is no samsara except where is nirvana. For the condition of existence is not of a mutually exclusive character. Therefore it is said that all things are non-dual, as are nirvana and samsara." Translated by Suzuki. But the equation nirvana is samsara is true in another sense as well, namely, that what appears to us to be samsara is really nirvana, and that what appears to be the world of form, rupa, is really the void, sunya. Hence the famous saying, form is not different from emptiness, emptiness is not different from form. Form is precisely emptiness, emptiness is precisely form. Once again, this is not to say that awakening will cause the world of form to vanish without trace, for nirvana is not to be sought as the future annihilation of the senses and their fields. The sutra is saying that form is void, just as it is, in all its prickly uniqueness. The point of this equation is not to assert a metaphysical proposition, but to assist the process of awakening. For awakening will not come to pass when one is trying to escape or change the everyday world of form, or to get away from the particular experience in which one finds oneself at this moment. Every such attempt is a manifestation of grasping. Even the grasping itself is not to be changed by force, for body, awakening, is the five offences, and the five offences are body. If anyone regards body as something to be attained, to be cultivated by discipline, he is guilty of the pride of self. Some of these passages may suggest that the bodhisattva may just as well be an easy-going worldly fellow who, because samsara is nirvana anyhow, can go on living just as he pleases. He may be thoroughly deluded, but since even delusion is body, there would be no point in trying to change it. There is often a deceptive resemblance between opposite extremes. Lunatics frequently resemble saints, and the unaffected modesty of the sage often lets him seem to be a very ordinary person. Yet there is no easy way of pointing out the difference, of saying what it is that the ordinary worldly fellow does or does not do, which makes him different from a bodhisattva, or vice versa. The entire mystery of Zen lies in this problem, and we shall return to it at the proper time. It is enough to say here that the so-called ordinary person is only apparently natural, or perhaps that his real naturalness feels unnatural to him. In practice, it is simply impossible to decide, intentionally, to stop seeking for nirvana and to lead an ordinary life, for as soon as one's ordinary life is intentional, it is not natural. It is for this reason that the insistence of the Mahayana texts on the unattainability of nirvana and body is not something to be accepted, theoretically, as a mere philosophical opinion. One has to know in one's bones that there is nothing to be grasped. Quote, thereupon the thought came to some of the gods in that assembly. What the fairies talk and murmur, that we understand, though mumbled. What Subhuti has just told us, that we do not understand. Subhuti read their thoughts and said, there is nothing to understand. There is nothing to understand. For nothing in particular has been indicated. Nothing in particular has been explained. No one will grasp this perfection of wisdom as here explained. For no Dharma, doctrine, at all has been indicated, lit up or communicated. So there will be no one who can grasp it. From Ashtasahasrika, translated by Kanz. The point arrives, then, when it is clearly understood that all one's intentional acts, desires, ideals, stratagems, are in vain. In the whole universe, within and without, there is nothing whereon to lay any hold, and no one to lay any hold on anything. This has been discovered through clear awareness of everything that seemed to offer a solution, or to constitute a reliable reality, through the intuitive wisdom called prajna, which sees into the relational character of everything. With the eye of prajna, the human situation is seen for what it is, a quenching of thirst with salt water, a pursuit of goals which simply require the pursuit of other goals, a clutching of objects which the swift course of time renders as insubstantial as mist. The very one who pursues, who sees and knows and desires, the inner subject, has his existence only in relation to the ephemeral objects of his pursuit. He sees that his grasp upon the world is his stranglehold about his own neck, the hold which is depriving him of the very life he so longs to attain. And there is no way out, no way of letting go, which he can take by effort, by a decision of the will. But who is it that wants to get out. There comes a moment when this consciousness of the inescapable trap in which we are at once the trapper and the trapped reaches a breaking point. One might almost say that it matures or ripens, and suddenly there is what the Lankavatara Sutra calls a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. In this moment, all sense of constraint drops away, and the cocoon which the silkworm spun around himself opens to let him go forth winged as a moth. The peculiar anxiety which Kierkegaard has rightly seen to lie at the very roots of the ordinary man's soul is no longer there. Contrivances, ideals, ambitions, and self-propitiations are no longer necessary, since it is now possible to live spontaneously without trying to be spontaneous. Indeed, there is no alternative, since it is now seen that there never was any self to bring the self under its control. Reduced to the bare essentials, such is the inner process which the Sunyavada is trying to set in motion with its philosophy of total negation. Thus, the greater part of Nagarjuna's work was a carefully logical and systematic refutation of every philosophical position to be found in the India of his time. Granting that its object is an inner experience, Western students have always had difficulty in understanding how such a purely negative point of view could have any creative consequences. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.